This is Conversations on Healthcare. Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we've been getting some interesting numbers from around the country on the drop in the rate of uninsured Americans in the wake of the Affordable Care Act. Of course, those numbers rate differently from state to state. Here in our home state in Connecticut, we've seen some terrific numbers. After just one season of open enrollment, our uninsured rate is down to around 4%, but our rates were already particularly low compared to other states.
Overall, the national uninsured rate as of July of this year is 13.2%. That's down from around 18% before open enrollment began, and that is the lowest rate since mid-2008.
But if you factor in those states that chose not to expand Medicaid for more of its citizens, not only have their uninsured numbers remained high, so have their insurance rates on the individual insurance market. All of these changes in health policy are affecting the medical profession as well, and our guest today has a keen insight into that side of the equation.
Dr. Harvey Feinberg has presided over thousands of public health studies in his role as the president of the Institute of Medicine, and he'll share some unique insights into the progress that they have made at the Institute of Medicine in developing evidence-based recommendations for policies that will improve healthcare delivery, training, and public health.
Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org, stops by uncovering misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio.
And as always, if you have comments, email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Harvey Feinberg in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Todd Park is stepping down, but not out. The nation's chief technology officer, who has been spearheading a move to bring government and the White House into the 21st century technology zone, is leaving that post, and he's returning to his roots. The once successful tech entrepreneur is going back to home turf, Silicon Valley, in an effort to recruit more top tech talent to lend expertise to Washington, as well as to keep abreast of the latest tech developments and breakthroughs. Park, whose mantra was "release the data" when he was chief technology officer for Health and Human Services, has since broadened his influence in government to make more federal data accessible via technology. Birth control is supposed to be free to all American women under the Affordable Care Act, but the recent Supreme Court Hobby Lobby decision added a great degree of confusion to the law's regulations. The White House has since responded with a modified rule on the subject that women who work for religious nonprofits opposed to providing birth control on religious grounds can seek full coverage under the federal government. So women who work for religious nonprofits will have access to birth control at no cost under a procedure the Obama administration said would also relieve their employers of any moral obligations. Back to school to learn the golden rule. But according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, that return should come later in the day. Studies show American teens most in need of a decent night's sleep are sleepwalking through a large portion of their day due to sleep deprivation, and it's neither good for their learning or their health. They're recommending high school days begin later than the typical 7 a.m. hour, 8:30 in the morning instead, and keep them in longer through the day. The typical teenager is getting an estimated 6 to 7 hours of sleep per night, when pediatricians agree it should be 8 to 10, ideally. Pediatric health experts see this sleep deprivation as a major unaddressed health issue. School districts are not quick to catch on, though. Currently, only 15% of the nation's middle and high schools begin after 8:30 in the morning. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Harvey Feinberg, president of the Institute of Medicine, the health branch of the National Academy of Sciences, that works to provide unbiased and authoritative advice to decision makers and the public on matters of public health. Dr. Feinberg served as the provost at Harvard University from 1997 to 2001, following 13 years as dean of the Harvard School of Public Health. Dr. Feinberg co-founded and served as president of the Society for Medical Decision Making and is an author of several books, including Clinical Decision Analysis and Innovators in Physician Education. Dr. Feinberg earned his MD and PhD at Harvard and is the recipient of several honorary degrees and numerous awards, including the Frank A. Calderon Prize, which is the highest prize in public health. Dr. Feinberg, thanks so much for joining us on Conversations in Healthcare.
My pleasure to be with you.
You know, the Institute of Medicine really requires an interesting orchestration. You oversee the efforts of 9 boards and 15 standing forums and roundtables, managing some 3,000 volunteers, all engaged in IOM's quest to improve public health in this country. And for the benefit of our listeners who may not be that familiar with the work being done at the Institute, could you give us some insight into the work you're tasked with at IOM and highlights of what you think some of the most important areas of research are?
The Institute of Medicine is the nation's advisor to improve health. We are an independent non-government organization dedicated to improving decision-making and helping policymakers, professionals, and the public come to better choices about health. The scope of our work is as wide as the nation's health agenda. We work on the needs of disadvantaged populations, on children, on elderly, for our veterans and military populations. We work on the problems of prevention of disease and population health. We're deeply immersed in the challenges of health care and improving the practice of medical care. And we have groups working on health science and policy as it relates to all manner of activities that bear on health, whether it's nutrition or environment or other ways in which we can improve our health. So the writ of the Institute of Medicine is quite broad. It's domestic. It's also global. But all of it is focused on the goal of improving health.
Well, Dr. Feinberg, I know that from where you sit and the long arc of your career, that you realize that maybe there's been no time in the history of healthcare in our country where the potential, at least for transformation, is so great. And you've said that to achieve greater public health, we have to align the incentives for all the stakeholders, the providers and the policymakers and the public. So in this moment in time, you're someone who's scrutinized the creation and the implementation of public health policies for the better part of your career. Share with us and our listeners, what's your take on the Affordable Care Act and its potential for this transformation?
The Affordable Care Act is one step along a long trajectory in the United States about increasing access to health care. Literally, this goes back to before the Great Depression of the 1930s and the early discussions about widening access to health insurance. There were proposals that President Roosevelt made, President Truman, President Kennedy, President Reagan, all put forward various proposals related to health. And President Obama did succeed in putting forward and having enacted our current extension of insurance through the Affordable Care Act. It's going to have a lot of questions raised about it in a continuing political struggle. But from a healthcare point of view, its core contribution is that it does increase access to services for millions of Americans who otherwise lack insurance. And that is a positive thing. It also has provisions that strengthen the preventive services in our country, including, for example, mandating that certain preventive care be available without copayment. So it's a step forward. It's going to have its difficulties in implementation. And I believe that we will continue to see in our country efforts to intensify and expand availability of health care to everyone in the country.
Dr. Feinberg, you focus much of your work on prevention. However, you've noted in the past that there are 7 deadly sins that impact public health every day that you think pose a real challenge to those tasked with creating sustainable public health policies. And tell our listeners what they are and what you see the solutions to be.
It's inspired, obviously, by the original 7 deadly sins that were first enunciated by Pope Gregory I back in the 6th century.
Haven't changed much.
Well, you know, lust, sloth, right. Gluttony, greed, wrath, right. Envy, and pride, you know, the 7th deadly sin. So,
yes,
they're all still with us. For public health, I adopted some of them. I said, well, you know, sloth blocks us from doing the things every day that would keep us healthy. Gluttony cajoles us into eating more even when we're not hungry. Mm-hmm. And greed is certainly a driver in some corporate settings to market and profit from things that are bad for health, such as cigarettes. So I adopted additional sins. I said, well, ignorance is an important deadly sin for public health. It always colors judgment and leads to poor decision making. Now, for the seventh deadly sin of public health, I chose obstinacy, which is the refusal to accept evidence on what would actually be best for our own health. Interestingly, I did a little exercise with the community here at the Institute of Medicine, our staff, and I asked them, what would they choose as the seventh deadly sin of public health if they had a choice? And we got some very interesting answers. For example, arrogance, hypocrisy, denial, procrastination, and selfishness. And then someone suggested the deadly sin of silence. I might add that we decided to do a little exercise on what would be the seven living virtues of public health that could counteract these deadly sins: moderation, mm-hmm. prevention, empathy, science, service, collaboration, selflessness, leadership, honesty, partnership, patience. So I thought the exercise was quite revealing and taught me that there are actually more than seven deadly sins and seven living virtues of public health.
So, Dr. Feinberg, the Institute of Medicine, we noted a few moments ago, has produced so many seminal reports on so many areas within healthcare. But your most downloaded report in the history of issuing these reports is the report published in 2010 on the future of nursing. Just unveiled a follow-up to that report. Take us to that future of nursing. What were the recommendations, some of the actions that have been taken since then to move us forward, and also some of the reactions within the healthcare community?
This has been a really gratifying effort because the future of nursing is so critical to the future of health in America. And we have not been fully capitalizing on the potential of nursing to contribute. The key recommendation out of this effort was to enable nurses to practice up to the full extent of their training and ability. Many states still had on the books limitations that restricted the ability of nurses to contribute in the ways that they should in primary care settings, for example. A number of states, in fact, by now, every state and the District of Columbia established what we call action collaborations. And in the ensuing several years, at least seven states have actually modified their rules and regulations that give wider latitude of practice for nursing. This report, 3 years after its release, continues to be actively downloaded from the Institute of Medicine website. But what's more gratifying than the readers of the report is the actions that have adopted the recommendations.
We're speaking today with Dr. Harvey Feinberg, president of the Institute of Medicine. Dr. Feinberg has served as provost of Harvard University and dean of the Harvard School of Public Health. He is the author of several books, including Clinical Decision Analysis and Innovators in Physician Education. Dr. Feinberg, one of your specific areas of study over the years has been in decision-making, specifically clinical decision-making. And let's look at the decision-making on the policy side for a moment. And we've seen the effects of that lack of action. And what might politicians learn from your work in clinical decision-making that might help them make more decisive policies aimed at improving the public health?
One of the things that you learn as you study decision-making, that failing to decide is also a decision. You can't avoid decisions in life. That's true whether we're talking about an individual in a clinical setting or we're talking about policymakers. A big difference, of course, is that in the case of an individual in clinical decision-making, the choice is about that one person, whereas policymakers are choosing and deciding for a nation or mm-hmm. for a state or for the whole body politic. And a second feature of all decisions is that they take account of our values and preferences. In a body politic, in a legislature, you've got many values and contending preferences that are obviously working often against one another. So the key, I think, for policymaking is really the notion of compromise. Now, compromise and making a deal is not the same as achieving consensus. It's not that everyone in the end has to agree. Rather, everyone has to be willing to participate in the give and take that results in an agreement.
Dr. Feinberg, I sort of want to take this a little into the future. And somebody who has a particular interest in the education and training of healthcare professionals, they're going to carry us into that future. We see an enormous amount of change starting to happen. I wonder if you'd share maybe your vision for this recalibration of the education and training of healthcare professionals and where you think it needs to go.
Health education is fundamental if we're going to have the future workforce to meet the health needs of the public. And that's a workforce that is across the whole spectrum of preparation in physician training and nursing training and public health training and pharmacy training and social service training and so on. There was a very interesting report of the Lancet Commission about 3 years ago on the future health workforce that emphasized the idea of learning across the disciplines and team-based learning. I think you can identify certain key principles that are going to be very, very important. One of them is the idea of continuous learning. Science is always advancing new knowledge and new practices, new technologies. The knowledge base that they have is going to be turning over multiple times if they're going to remain current through a career of 30, 40 years. And so the capacity for continuous learning has to be built in to learning from the beginning. The idea of teamwork that I mentioned is a second aspect that is not always realized in practice to the degree that it must be for us to provide optimal care for patients. We know that patients with chronic disease particularly require team-based care to have optimal management of their conditions. Learning together across the professions is a really good way to help reinforce the kind of practicing teamwork that is needed and is important preparation for teamwork. A third really important challenge, I think, for the future is going to be the combination of information technology and maintaining the personal touch, contact, and relationship that healing requires. So practitioners of the future are going to have to be adept simultaneously with a more technological world, a world immersed in big data and information, and at the same time retain the capacity to establish those personal relationships that are the heart of clinical care and healing. I think it's going to be very important for everyone to keep patients literally centered as the heart of our focus and attention. It's more than just the moment when an individual is a patient. It's about their needs at every stage in relation to their health and how does the public health system serve to reinforce positive aspects of health. So all of these things, I think, are going to be core features of future health education. We are going to have to find ways to make education ever more efficient and cost-effective if we're going to have a sustainable system. So that means examining the time required, the division of educational levels at undergraduate, at clinical and preclinical training, and later in specialty and in lifelong education. All of this, I think, is on the table. All of it needs attention, and all of it will help us shape a health education system that will prepare the clinician leaders for delivery of better care in the future.
That's just a wonderful global response to the question. I want to pull the thread a little more on the conversation you were having about the future, and particularly with emerging 21st century technologies. And we've seen this growth of mobile health and genomics and computers like Watson sort of being programmed to assist clinicians in healthcare. You talked about big data, and I think we want to get from big data to big wisdom as well. And you recently gave a very popular TED Talk about the era of neo-evolution we're entering. So in many ways, the future is here, but you're also concerned at the Institute of Medicine with ensuring that these technologies are properly vetted and studied for the potential to do harm as well as to do good. So how do we accelerate the pace of research in these areas? And I think we've cited a couple of times on the show from bench to bedside is like 17 years. Talk to us about how we bring about this transformative powers to healthcare and while we're still protecting the population.
There's so many dimensions of this that we really need to attend to almost simultaneously. When it comes to the data explosion that we're facing that can be a force for good, I think that we need to always keep in mind that data is not the same as information. Information is not knowledge, and knowledge is not itself wisdom to choose. So I think we need to be able to apply that data, but in an interpreted way, to give us the knowledge base and ultimately the most sensible choices for the benefit of people. I think a really critical part of finding our way through this challenging future is going to be actively engaged patients. The power of patients to take more control of their own lives, to have more mastery of available knowledge, to be more actively engaged in the management of their own conditions, to be more active as partners with their clinical providers, to be able to give a voice to their preferences and their own values at every stage of life and illness, including at the end of life. These are all going to be, I think, a very important touchstone to how we can cope with all of the many pressures that you describe. When it comes to specifically this problem of the long delay between discovery and availability of new technologies that would potentially extend life and improve the quality of life, we do have, I think, a very serious policy and technological task ahead of ourselves. We do need to find ways to continue to reinforce invention, entrepreneurship, to harmonize regulations and make it possible for innovators to produce their new ideas and convert those into technologies that will benefit patients, and do this while we are still protecting the public and patients against adverse reactions as far as we can, and even dangerous technologies and substances. So this can only be accomplished if we develop and optimize regulatory science as well as basic and clinical science. We need to focus on translation, which to NIH's credit has been a major theme through the clinical and translational science activities that it has supported in recent years. And from a policy point of view, we need to find ways to provide a better incentives for investors and entrepreneurs in this critical period when the technology is promising but not yet a product, so that it's advantageous to develop genuinely novel advances and not simply work on the me too substances that make only marginal improvements. Mm-hmm.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Harvey Fineberg, president of the Institute of Medicine and former provost and dean of the School of Public Health at Harvard University. You can learn more about his work by going to iom.edu or by following the Institute of Medicine on Facebook or Twitter. Dr. Fineberg, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
It's been my pleasure to talk with you.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, do some Republican Senate candidates want to ban birth control? That's the claim we're seeing in a few races across the country, and it's a reference to the issue of personhood. For instance, in Colorado, where a personhood initiative is on the ballot in November, Democratic Senator Mark Udall has been saying in TV ads that his challenger, Republican Representative Cory Gardner, embarked on an 8-year crusade that would ban birth control. That's a reference to Gardner's support for the state personhood initiatives, which were also on the ballot in 2008 and 2010. These anti-abortion measures don't explicitly call for a ban on birth control, but they could lead to some forms of birth control being illegal. Why? Well, these measures generally say that the rights of people would apply to the unborn from the moment of fertilization. And while the birth control pill, the most common form of contraception, and IUDs mainly prevent pregnancy by preventing ovulation, they also can stop a fertilized egg from implanting in the uterine wall. So it's questionable whether these hormonal forms of birth control would still be legal. No personhood measure has passed, and a court case would likely determine the impact. Representative Gardner, meanwhile, says he has changed his mind and no longer supports the initiative in Colorado precisely because it could ban some forms of birth control. However, he still backs a federal bill, which also would make a ban of some contraception a possibility. Gardner announced his change of position in March, 8 months after he had signed on as a co-sponsor to the federal Life at Conception Act, which Gardner's camp says wouldn't affect contraception. But it has the same language about extending the rights of people, in this case under the 14th Amendment, to the preborn from the moment of fertilization. That's the language that raises the birth control concerns. So neither side is telling the full story. Udall's ads fail to explain that the reference is to the personhood initiative, an anti-abortion measure that could ban some birth control. Gardner has changed his mind on the state measure, but he still supports a federal bill that prompts the same questions over birth control. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. The U.S. boasts among the highest rates of teen births in the world's industrialized nations. And while those numbers have been declining in recent years, it's still a significant health issue in this country. According to a recent study, the decline in teen birth rates in this country can be attributed in part to the launch of the popular MTV show 16 and Pregnant and the subsequent Teen Mom. MTV launched the series in 2009 to show the challenges and harsh realities of teen pregnancy and teen parenthood. Researchers at the University of Maryland and Wellesley College conducted an empirical study to determine what, if any, impact the shows had on the decline of teen pregnancy and birth. Wellesley College economist Philip Levine found that much of the decline in recent years is the result of the Great Recession, but that it didn't account for all of the decline. They decided to utilize Google data tracker and Twitter activity around the airing of the shows, which developed a loyal following and consistently high ratings since the show began in 2009.
You know, it's remarkable how people respond to the show, do things like tweet and search about things that they're watching on TV as they're watching. So you see these enormous spikes in activity about 16 and Pregnant the day the episode airs. You just see this huge spike in activity, and that also tends to correlate with people doing things like searching and tweeting about birth control.
More interestingly were the social media conversations surrounding themes explored on the show. Loss of freedom, the fathers of the baby often removing themselves from the picture. Themes that really drove the challenge of teen motherhood home to millions of young, vulnerable viewers.
It really illustrates the life choices that these girls have made and what outcomes it has on their lives in a way that a reality TV show can do that a public service announcement or a sex education teacher or some other form of communication can't really accomplish.
Based on the data they compiled, they determined the show led to a 5.7% drop in teen births from 2009 2009 to 2012, a significant number in the relatively short period of time. The study can be found in the National Bureau of Economic Research, a media outlet utilizing airwaves to reveal the risk of teen pregnancy, thus creating a platform for dialogue for teens to address this potentially life-changing event, leading to a significant reduction in teen pregnancy. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.